pull up a chair. Before the parade down Fifth Avenue, before the ticker tape and the medals and the whole world screaming his name, before Paris, there was a skinny college dropout standing on the top wing of a Lincoln Standard biplane, 700 feet over a Nebraska cornfield, holding on with nothing but his knees and his nerve, while the farmers below shaded their eyes and said a prayer for the fool up there. That fool was Charles Lindbergh. And nobody knew his name yet. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Taildragger. And today on The Hangar, we're not going to talk about the Atlantic. Everybody talks about the Atlantic. Today we're going to talk about the 4 years before it, the barnstorming years, the years that made him. Because the Lone Eagle didn't just wake up one morning knowing how to fly across an ocean. He learned it the hard way, out on the Great Plains, sleeping under a wing, passing the hat at county fairs, betting his life on a $2 parachute and a used airplane he couldn't quite afford. Now before we get rolling, let me tell you today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. And I'll tell you what, young Lindbergh earned every mile the hard way, one jump at a time. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's set the scene. It's the spring of 1922. Charles Lindbergh is 20 years old, and by most measures, he's a flop. He'd gone off to the University of Wisconsin to study engineering and he'd flunked out. Couldn't keep his mind on the books. What he could keep his mind on was the roar of an engine and the idea of leaving the ground. So he did something his mother worried about, and most sensible people thought was insane. He sent his tuition money to the Nebraska Aircraft Corporation in Lincoln, and he signed up to learn to fly. Now here's where it gets interesting. That flight school? It was one airplane. A single Lincoln Standard biplane. A big open cockpit trainer. And Lindbergh was the only student in the whole outfit. He showed up on the 1st of April, 1922, walked into that factory, and the man showed him the airplane they were building. The smell of it, fresh dope on the fabric, that sharp banana oil sweetness that anybody who's ever hung around a restoration shop knows in their bones, castor oil and gasoline, sawdust and glue. He took his first flight ride a week later, and that was it, that was the whole ball game. He was gone, but here's the part they don't put in the storybooks. Lindbergh got some instruction, a little. And then the company sold that airplane, sold it right out from under the school, to a barnstormer. And the deal was the barnstormer wanted somebody to come along and help him work the crowds. So Lindbergh had a decision to make. He had maybe 8 hours of dual instruction. 8 hours. He had never soloed, not once. And the company wanted him to sign off on the airplane leaving, which meant his flying lessons were over before they'd really started. What does a 20-year-old with more nerve than sense do? He becomes a wing walker. Understand what I'm telling you, the kid could barely fly, but there was money in barnstorming, and the money wasn't in flying the airplane. The money was in what you did while somebody else flew it. The crowds didn't pay to watch a fellow take off and land. They paid to watch a man cheat death, so Lindbergh went to work for a barnstormer named Arald Ball. And when Ball told him he'd take him on but couldn't pay him, Lindbergh offered to pay his own expenses just to come along. That's how bad he wanted it. And pretty soon Lindbergh figured out how to earn his keep. He climbed out onto the wing. Now I want you to really picture this, because we've gotten soft and safe in aviation, and thank God for it, but we've forgotten what these people actually did. You're standing in an open cockpit. The airplane's doing maybe 70, 80 miles an hour. The slipstream is a wall of wind trying to peel you off the airframe and throw you into the tail. There are no seatbelts to speak of once you leave that cockpit. There is no parachute half the time. There is you, and the fabric-covered wing, and the wires, and about 1,000 feet of Nebraska air between you and the dirt, and you climb out. You put a boot on the lower wing, you grab a strut, you feel the whole airplane flex and shudder, and you work your way out to the wingtip, while a crowd of farmers and school kids and pretty girls in Sunday dresses go dead silent below you. Then you climb up onto the top wing, you stand up, and you let go. Just for a second, arms out, the wind screaming, the world tilting under you. That's what put food on the table. That's what Charles Lindbergh did for a living before he was famous. And they gave him a name for it, out there on the county fair circuit. They billed him as Daredevil Lindbergh. He'd stand on that wing, he'd hang from the landing gear by his knees, and the big finale, the one that emptied people's pockets into the hat, was the parachute jump. Let me tell you about the parachutes, because this is the part that separates the men from the boys. In 1922, a parachute was not the reliable, packed, spring-loaded lifesaver you strap on today. Out on the barnstorming circuit, a lot of these jumps were done with what they called a double drop. You'd have two parachutes. You'd cut away the first one on purpose, fall free, and then open the second. The crowd loved it. They thought the first shoot had failed. They thought they were watching a man die. Lindbergh did his first jump with a borrowed rig, and on that first double drop, the second parachute nearly didn't come out. The rope that was supposed to pull it broke. He fell, tumbling, watching the ground come up, working the problem the way he'd work every problem for the rest of his life, cold, methodical. He got it open, barely. Most men would have kissed the earth and taken a desk job. Lindbergh figured out what went wrong, fixed the rigging himself, and jumped again and again. He became a professional parachute jumper. That was a job title. Traveling parachute jumper. He'd hire himself out to whatever barnstormer was passing through, drop out of somebody else's airplane over somebody else's cornfield, collect his fee, and move on down the line. Back when avgas was cheap and airspace was free, that's how a young man learned this business. Not in a classroom. In the slipstream. Now let's talk about the airplanes, because I promised you warbirds and restorations, and this is the closest thing barnstorming had to a warbird. The airplane that made the barnstorming era possible was the Curtiss Jenny, the JN-4, after the Great War ended in 1918. The government had thousands of these training biplanes and no use for them, so they sold them off as surplus. Crated up, brand new, some of them for a few hundred dollars. There were stories of men buying a Jenny for $50 and getting a spare engine thrown in. That flood of cheap airplanes is the whole reason the barnstorming era happened. Suddenly, any young man with a little cash and a death wish could own an airplane and go tour the country. And in 1923, that's exactly what Charles Lindbergh did. He went down to Souther Field, down in Americus, Georgia, where the surplus Jennies were sold, and he bought himself one. Paid $500 for it. A Curtiss Jenny with a brand new engine, a fresh coat of dope, and an extra 20-gallon fuel tank. He talked them down to $500, and that included some free flight time to get comfortable in it. There was just one problem. Charles Lindbergh had never soloed an airplane in his life. Think about that. He'd been wing-walking for a year. He'd jumped out of airplanes a couple dozen times. He was billed across the Midwest as Daredevil Lindbergh, and he had never once taken off, flown around, and landed an airplane all by himself. So he buys this Jenny at Souther Field, and now he's got to learn to fly the thing before he can leave. He taxis it around, he does a few hops with another pilot, and then one evening he decides it's time. He's going to solo, he gets it into the air. And he finds out real quick that flying a Jenny by yourself for the first time is a whole different animal than riding along. He porpoised it, bounced it, made a mess of the first landing attempt, and a fellow pilot who happened to be there hopped in and gave him a little more coaching, and then Lindbergh went up, alone, as the sun was going down over Georgia, and he taught himself to fly. His first solo and his first airplane on the same day, in an airplane he already owned. That's not how we do it now, thank goodness, but that was Lindbergh. He spent a week down there just practicing takeoffs and landings, all by himself, in the cool of the morning and the calm of the evening, until he trusted himself. And then he pointed the Jenny north and became a barnstormer in his own right. Now here's the part I love. He flew all over the middle of the country. Nebraska, Kansas, the Dakotas, down into Texas, Wisconsin, Minnesota. He'd spot a likely pasture near a town, circle it low to scare off the cattle and get the locals looking up and set down in the grass. And by the time the propeller stopped turning, half the county would be running across the field to look at the flying machine. $5 a ride, sometimes less. He'd take them up. One or two at a time, bank around the town so they could see their own house and their own church from the air for the very first time in their lives. And you have to remember, for most of these people, this was it. This was the only time they would ever leave the ground. A farmer who'd spent 60 years walking behind a plow, and for 5 minutes on a Sunday afternoon, a 21-year-old kid showed him what a hawk sees. That's what barnstorming really was, underneath the daredevil stuff. It was the airplane introducing itself to America, town by town. Pasture by pasture, $5 at a time. He slept under the wing, wrapped up in a blanket, listening to the tick of the cooling engine, the crickets, the wind moving the grass. He fixed his own engine, patched his own fabric, scrounged his own gas. There was a night he came down in a farmer's field, and the farmer's family took him in and fed him supper. And that was the pay for the day. And Lindbergh, being Lindbergh, kept notes. He watched the weather. He watched his fuel. He learned dead reckoning navigation the way you learn it, when getting lost means coming down in a strange field before dark. He learned to read the country below him like a map, follow the railroad tracks, the rivers, the roads. He was building something, one flight at a time, though he didn't know it yet. Because here's the thing. Every skill that carried him across the Atlantic in 1927, he learned barnstorming, the patience to sit alone in a cockpit for hour after hour. the discipline to watch his fuel like a hawk, the cold nerve to keep working a problem when the ground was coming up, the navigation by compass and clock and the shape of the land, the mechanical feel for an engine, knowing by the sound and the vibration when something's about to go wrong. He didn't learn any of that in the Army flight school he went to later, though that sharpened him, and he sure didn't learn it in college. He learned it out on the plains, standing on a wing, jumping out of somebody else's airplane, nursing a $500 Jenny across 1,000 miles of nothing. Now here's where it gets interesting, and where the story kind of breaks your heart if you let it. The barnstorming era that made Lindbergh helped to end. When he flew the Atlantic in 27, he didn't just become famous, he made aviation respectable, serious. The money and the attention that his flight brought poured into airlines and airmail, and real airports with real runways. And within a few years, the government started regulating aviation properly. Pilots needed licenses, airplanes needed inspections, and you could no longer just buy a war surplus Jenny for a song, teach yourself to fly it in a week, and go drop out of the sky onto some farmer's back, 40. The wing walking, the double parachute drops, the cheap surplus airplanes, the whole gorgeous, reckless, dangerous circus of it. It faded out right around the time Lindbergh became the most famous man on Earth. He was the last great product of the barnstorming era. And he was one of the reasons it ended. I think about that skinny kid on the top wing sometimes. Daredevil Lindbergh, arms out in the slipstream, no parachute, betting his whole life on his knees and his nerve, while the farmers below held their breath. Nobody knew his name. He was just another barnstormer working the county fair circuit, one of hundreds of young men and a good many women out there selling America its first look at the sky. And within 5 years, he'd fly alone into history, but he was a barnstormer first. Don't let anybody tell you different. Most of what I've laid out today comes from Lindbergh's own writing. His little book called We and Later, The Spirit of St. Louis, along with the good folks at the Minnesota Historical Society and the Smithsonian, who've kept the records of those barnstorming years alive. You can find us anytime at radiohanger.com, so next time you're out at a fly-in and you see some old open cockpit biplane sitting in the grass, walk over and put your hand on that lower wing. That's where it all started, not in Paris. In a pasture, this is Tail Dragger. Keep the greasy side down and I'll see you next time.